KABU program has been made possible in part by KABU Foundation members and a grant from Pete's Coffee and Tea, celebrating 40 years with the arrival of Anniversary Blend Coffee and Tea. Portland locations on the web at PEETS.com.
Good morning. It's Monday, June 19th, 2006. Coming up, I'm Chris Andre.
And I'm Jake Wallner.
Coming right up on the KABU News at 7, Portland hosted a bicycle summit this Saturday. Deputy Secretary of State Robert Zoellick will announce his resignation today. The search for two American soldiers missing in Iraq continues. And North Korea is set to test an intercontinental ballistic missile over protests from Japan. Portland area weather today, morning clouds, partial afternoon clearing. Highs in the mid-60s to mid-70s, tonight mostly cloudy, lows in the 50s.
At the weekend bicycle conference, Jim Matto introduced himself in a thrifty way. Recovering auto user, I've been straight now 12 years. About 400 people who vigorously participated in a city-sponsored bike summit at Portland State University on Saturday. Saturday's summit followed last week's unveiling of a study commissioned by the Portland Office of Transportation that said bicycling has created a Portland business segment of 600 to 800 jobs while annually generating $63 million. The report also said that Portland averaged about 6 bike-related events per day. The summit was a chance for attendees to brainstorm how to become the first big city in the nation to achieve a platinum bicycling status with the attendant marketing plums. The key most agreed would require blending teamwork with hard work. Representative Earl Blumenauer said that it was important to get back to the basics of walking and pedaling and that he had saved hundreds of hours and thousands of dollars by riding a bike whenever possible. Yet public acceptance is far from complete. And he mentioned a time at the White House when guards questioned him when he showed up with a bike. This from the Oregonian.
The Sierra Club has endorsed Governor Ted Kulongoski for re-election because of his strong stance for roadless area protection and his efforts to bring cleaner, more fuel-efficient cars to Oregon. The club praised Kulongoski for standing up to the Bush administration on forest issues and the automobile industry and Republican legislators for adopting stronger tailpipe emission standards.
The debate over what to do about global warming remains divisive and politically charged, but few real scientists dispute we live on a planet where average temperatures are higher than they were a century ago and will continue to climb. In the Pacific Northwest, the effects are now seen and measurable. Today, we continue an occasional series examining how higher temperatures exert fundamental change on the Northwest's natural world and our lives. Research predicts that as greenhouse gases trap more heat in the oceans and skies, fierce storms will probably increase. They will whirl across seas brimming with water from melting ice caps, driving waves high enough to eat away beaches, highways, and homes. Storms have already strengthened, evidence shows, although the precise cause hides within an ever-changing web of weather. The state has started handing out a video to Oregon coastal homebuyers warning of rising sea levels and mounting waves. A rising sea by itself is not new, but as temperatures rise today, ice sheets covering Antarctica and Greenland are melting more rapidly than anticipated, and the rate of melt accelerates further, pushing the ocean upward. This from the Oregonian.
In January 2003, a small and angry army of citizens defeated Bechtel's plans to make Vallejo, California, a gateway for importing liquefied natural gas. 14 months later, and a coast away, the fishing village of Harpswell, Maine, voted to kill construction of a similar facility, sending ConocoPhillips and a partner packing. Like Vallejo residents, Maine fishermen were unwilling to risk environmental and safety threats against the promise of a construction boom, a few dozen permanent jobs, and millions of dollars in tax money for schools and services. Today, a handful of Oregon coastal communities are waging the same battles as the nation pushes to increase imports of natural gas. The rules have changed, however, diluting the weight of local opposition by giving the ultimate siting decision on LNG facilities to a federal agency. Those opposing LNG sites acknowledge their task has become more difficult, but even pitted against out-of-state speculators willing to gamble millions of dollars on the outcome. These school librarians, fishermen, and others are not surrendering the fight. The LNG policy shift contained in the 2005 energy bill followed a legal challenge by the state of California over whether states or the federal government hold the last word on such sites. Oregon and Washington filed legal papers supporting states' rights, but the energy bill handed authority to the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. This again from the Oregonian.
This week, fierce political rivals gathered at a golf resort to debate Oregon's land use policies, according to the Oregonian. The Urban Land Institute staged Oregon's equivalent of a Middle East peace conference by bringing together the most influential decision-makers engaged in the state's standoff over growth. State leaders still aren't sure how to absorb a million new Oregonians in the next two decades while keeping existing residents happy. In the 1970s, Oregon crafted a way to keep the country rural and shepherd people into cities, making the state famous for its quality of life. But strict planning rules upset people who wanted freedom to use their land as they wished. The tension finally exploded in 2002 when voters approved Measure 37, a property rights law excusing longtime landowners from rules that curbed their investment. But the fight didn't end. Activists angrily battled in the legislature and traded barbs in newspapers and on radio. It is a debate that must continue as the state struggles to absorb more and more people.
Healthcare advocates, hopes for making big changes with ballot initiatives this fall have fallen short. This leaves them once again to look to the legislature to help rein in rising costs and falling coverage. Legislators passed on a similar opportunity last year when they did not act on proposals to expand the Oregon Health Plan, boost the tobacco tax, provide insurance for more children, and add people to the state discount prescription drug pool. But lawmakers and advocates say the healthcare crisis has grown too hot for legislators to ignore. Last year's reforms ran aground partly on the legislature's partisan split, and it's unclear whether that will change with November's elections. Three initiatives with a chance of reaching the November ballot involve prescription drug discounts for patients without coverage, staffing levels in nursing homes, and a constitutional amendment declaring health care a right and requiring the legislature to move toward universal access to health care by mid-2009.
Across the country, a growing number of Latinos are taking on the hot, dangerous, and dirty work because the demand is high, and it usually pays better than farm work. Latinos dominate many wildfire crews. Rod Nichols, an Oregon Department of Forestry spokesman, said about 85% of the crews in Washington and Oregon are Latino. His office administers firefighting contracts with private companies for the two states. In Oregon, Nichols said, the forestry department tries to run a legal operation, but at the same time, we worry about the possibility of losing all those crews if an immigration crackdown scoops up big numbers of undocumented firefighters. Although there are usually enough firefighters, Nichols said there are problems. In bad years, such as 2002 when National Guard troops and crews from Canada and Australia were needed. This from the Salem Statesman Journal.
Hundreds of homes and businesses were threatened this morning by a wildfire that blackened 1,000 acres in northern Arizona's scenic Oak Creek Canyon. The fire started yesterday afternoon and spread quickly through the parched region, forcing the evacuation of about 400 homes and businesses in Oak Creek Canyon and about 100 homes in five Sedona subdivisions. Fire crews were positioned to protect homes from the fire, which had burned to within a mile of some of the buildings. Oak Creek Canyon, more than 90 miles north of Phoenix, is home to hotels, resorts, stores, and houses scattered across the area.
Deputy Secretary of State Robert Zoellick the Department No. 2 official, will announce his resignation today. Zelik has served 6 years in the Bush administration. He will join the investment house Goldman Sachs Group. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice is expected to make the announcement later today. Zelik is a former U.S. trade representative and reportedly wanted to be promoted to Treasury Secretary to replace departing Secretary John Snow, but President Bush nominated Goldman Sachs executive Henry Paulson instead. Ironic, isn't it? Zelik has been the administration's leading diplomat, handling the volatile situation in Sudan's western Darfur region. He was also the State Department's chief diplomat dealing with China.
National security concerns may delay for months the release of a risk assessment report on a proposed liquefied natural gas terminal near Astoria. The Coast Guard has agreed to withhold a waterway suitability assessment report by Northern Star Natural Gas, citing the Maritime Transportation Security Act of 2002. The required waterway risk assessment outlines safety and security issues, such as accidental spills and zones to protect the public from fires or gas leaks, or to protect ships from terrorism. It also examines the characteristics of the area and its available resources and space to provide those zones and the overall footprint of the liquefied gas operation. Northern Star plans to build a terminal on the Columbia River at Bradwood Landing and then ship the super-chilled natural gas to Bradwood, where the company hopes to build a $580 million import facility. Northern Star is one of four companies seeking to build LNG terminals on the river. All have sparked local opposition, but Northern Star's recent request to keep the record secret has raised new concerns about transparency and the public's rights.
The body of a man who apparently drowned in the floods that followed Hurricane Katrina was found under furniture in his once-flooded house, the coroner's chief investigator says. The New Orleans Forensic Center will test DNA to see whether the body is that of a 59-year-old man who lived there and had been missing since September, John Gagliano said. He had relatives made several trips to the house since Katrina, but the body was found only Wednesday by workers cleaning the house in eastern New Orleans. An autopsy found that the man had drowned. He was the 23rd apparent storm victim found in New Orleans since the Forensic Center took over body recovery from federal search teams in March. As of May 18th, the Louisiana Department of Health and Hospitals had counted 1,588 Louisiana deaths from Katrina, including 281 who died in other states after the storm.
Michael Chertoff's Homeland Security Department rejected thousands of newsreaders' complaints about funding after slashing New York's anti-terrorism funds. Homeland Security Chief Michael Chertoff now apparently thinks angry letters from New Yorkers are the real safety threat. When a Daily News reporter attempted to deliver scores of messages protesting the cuts to Chertoff's Washington office, he was promptly turned away. The letters, faxes, and printed emails would put all the employees here, including the secretary, at risk, said a Department of Homeland Security spokesperson. The dozens of envelopes containing New Yorkers' outrage at losing 40% of their security funds did go through an X-ray machine outside the government complex. This from the New York Daily News.
A group of American military deserters publicly embraced their new lives in Canada last Saturday with the support of peace mom Cindy Sheehan. Sheehan said she wished the son she lost in Iraq was among them. Sheehan was making her second visit to Canada in support of sanctuary for those fleeing the U.S. military. The Canadian government has so far denied political asylum to U.S. soldiers who have sought it, but appeals are pending. The gathering at a park in the town of Fort Erie, Ontario, was organized by peace groups on both sides of the border. About 20 former U.S. soldiers, referred to as war resistors, have applied for refugee status in Canada. Organizers estimated there may be as many as 200 soldiers in the country who have not yet sought formal protection. The soldiers thanked Canadians for their hospitality and were cheered by about 100 in an audience that included Iraq veterans opposed to the war and Vietnam-era resistors who sought refuge in Canada decades earlier. Sheehan, who energized the anti-war movement last summer with her month-long protest outside President Bush's Texas ranch, said she has spent time with many of the resistors. She said, "They're moral human beings who don't want to go to Iraq and kill innocent people to line the pockets of George Bush and the war machine."
The Washington Post has obtained a cable marked sensitive that says it shows that just before President Bush went to Baghdad last week, it says in part, the U.S. embassy in Iraq painted a starkly different portrait of increasing danger and hardship faced by its Iraqi employees. The Post reported yesterday that the cable outlines the daily worsening conditions for those who live outside the heavily guarded international zone, harassment, threats, and the employees' constant fears that their neighbors will discover they work for the U.S. government. The cable said it's actually far worse than that, as the details published below indicate, which include references to abductions, threats to women's rights, and ethnic cleansing. The cable was sent to the Secretary of State in Washington, D.C., from the American Embassy in Baghdad. The type name at the very bottom is Khalilzad, the name of the U.S. ambassador, though it's not known if this means that he wrote the memo or merely approved it. As a footnote in one of the 23 sections, the embassy relates, quote, an Arab newspaper editor told us he's preparing an extensive survey of ethnic cleansing, which he said is taking place in almost every Iraqi province as political parties and their militias are seemingly engaged in tit-for-tat reprisals all over Iraq, unquote. This from the Washington Post.
Now that the top White House aide, Karl Rove, is off the hook in the CIA leak probe, President Bush must weigh whether to pardon former vice presidential aide, Louis Scooter Libby, the only one indicted in the three-year investigation. Speculation about a pardon began in late October, soon after Special Counsel Patrick Fitzgerald unsealed the perjury indictment of Libby, and it continued last week after Fitzgerald chose not to charge Rove. The White House remains mum on the president's intentions. Spokeswoman Dana Perino declined to comment Friday. Libby was indicted for lying in Fitzgerald's probe into who in the administration leaked the identity of covert CIA officer Valerie Plame to reporters in 2003, apparently to undercut her husband's attack on Bush's war, justifying claim that Iraq sought uranium in Niger. By demanding sensitive, sometimes embarrassing materials, some say Libby appears to be goading the White House into issuing a pardon. Libby's spokeswoman did not respond to questions about a pardon. A pardon before the trial could cut off the disclosures and spare Vice President Dick Cheney from testifying as Fitzgerald's witness about Libby. But the timing of a pardon, the attorney suggested, likely would depend on the outcome of the midterm elections.
The U.S. Episcopal Church has chosen a woman as its next leader, making it the first church anywhere in the Anglican denomination to do so. Catherine Jeffetts Shorey narrowly won a vote among her fellow bishops at a governing general convention meeting. The choice must still be approved by delegates at the convention, where the bishop's vote is normally backed. The choice could prove controversial. Most other Anglican churches around the world do not allow women to be bishops. The bishops voted 95-93 to back Shorey after a number of ballots. A total of 7 candidates were in the running for the post. This from the BBC.
Not even the President of the United States can get Eddie Favor to wear pants. Like many of his constituents, the mayor of Bay St. Louis, Mississippi, lost everything but the clothes he was wearing when Hurricane Katrina flattened Mississippi's Gulf Coast. Favre turned his misfortune into a vow. He's not shedding his Bermuda shorts until his city is back on its feet. President Bush joked about Favre's attire when they shared a stage. Journalists gawked at his black shorts and tuxedo top when he showed up in March at the annual Radio and Television Correspondents Association dinner in Washington. Favor welcomes the ribbing and stares as long as it keeps a spotlight trained on his city, which before Katrina was known for beachfront summer homes, quaint shops, and a thriving art colony. Now the city is littered with bare concrete slabs where homes once stood, boarded up businesses, and government-issued trailer homes. Many of the Gulf Coast's smaller cities are scrounging for money to plug gaping budget holes and jumpstart the glacial pace of Katrina recovery. Meanwhile, a frustrated Favor says he's reduced to serving as a moral booster while he presses state and federal officials to deliver aid to homeowners in the city.
military said today that 7 American troops have been wounded, 3 insurgents have been killed, and 34 detained during an intensive search for 2 missing American soldiers. Fighter jets, unmanned aerial vehicles, and dive teams had been deployed to find the 2 men. The men went missing Friday during an attack on their checkpoint in the volatile Sunni area south of Baghdad that left 1 of their comrades dead. The Defense Department identified the missing men as Private First Class Christian Menacha of Houston, Texas, and Private First Class Thomas Tucker of Madras, Oregon.
Prosecutors have requested the indictment of a U.S. soldier over the shooting of an Italian intelligence agent at a checkpoint in Iraq last year, the ANSA news agency reports today. The death of Nicola Calipari by U.S. gunfire strained relations between Italy and the United States. The agent was headed by car to Baghdad airport shortly after securing the release of an Italian journalist who had been kidnapped in the Iraqi capital when he was shot at the checkpoint. Another agent who was driving the car and the journalist Giuliani Segrana were wounded. U.S. authorities have said the vehicle was traveling fast, alarming soldiers who feared an insurgent attack. Italian officials claim the car was traveling at normal speed and blamed U.S. military for failing to signal there was a checkpoint.
And the BBC has this question for listeners. Are you a resident of Ramadi? We'd like to hear from you.
An environmental disaster is brewing in the heartland of Iraq's northern Sunni-led insurgency, according to Ross Story. Iraqi officials say that in a desperate move to dispose of millions of barrels of an oil refinery byproduct called black oil, the government pumped it into open mountain valleys and leaked reservoirs next to the Tigris River and set it on fire. Today, New York Times reports that the resulting huge black bogs are threatening the river and the precious groundwater in the area. The suffocating plumes of smoke are carried as far as 65 kilometers or 40 miles downwind to Tikrit. An Iraqi environmental engineer who has visited the area described it as kind of a black swampland consisting of oil-saturated terrain and large standing pools of oil stretching across several mountain valleys. At Iraq's damaged and outdated refineries, as much as 40% of what is produced pours forth as this heavy, vicious substance, which used to be extensively exported to more efficient foreign operations for further refining. But the insurgency has stalled government-controlled exports from the area containing Iraq's major northern refinery complex at Beji.
Japan has warned it will lodge a fierce protest with the United Nations Security Council if North Korea test fires a long-range missile as planned. The untested Taipodong 2 is believed to have a range of almost 4,000 miles with a light payload, allowing it to reach parts of the United States. North Korea reportedly ordered its people to raise the state flag and expect a television message. But the scheduled time passed without an address from the government. Japanese Defense Agency officials concluded that a launch was not imminent, but that monitoring that would continue, Japan's news press agency reported. The Korea Central News Agency later issued a statement in which it criticized the attitude of the U.S. and Japan towards North Korea. Earlier, Japanese Foreign Minister Taro Aso had said Tokyo could impose sanctions on North Korea in response to a test, and he stressed that the necessary Japanese legislation already existed. This from the BBC.
Rival Palestinian factions, Hamas and Fatah, are close to agreement on an initiative that would implicitly recognize Israel, according to the BBC. Senior figures have been in talks to resolve deep divisions over the move. Hamas, which now controls the Palestinian government, refuses to recognize Israel's right to exist, in contrast to Fatah's position. President Mahmoud Abbas has threatened to hold a referendum next month on the plan unless Hamas accepts it. Western powers have agreed moves to release more than $120 million of EU funds to support local health services and cater for the basic needs of poor Palestinians, but bypassing the Hamas government. The plan, known as the Prisoners Document, is based on proposals by Palestinian militants in Israeli jails.
The government of Bolivia has announced a radical plan to reduce poverty and create employment in the poorest country in South America. Almost $7 billion will be invested in ambitious public works programs. The economic plan, announced by Planning and Development Minister Carlos Villegas, aims to create 100,000 jobs a year for the next 5 years. It's the latest measure in a series implemented by President Evo Morales since taking office in January. The people of South America, and especially Bolivia, have often heard their leaders promise to reduce poverty and create jobs. But President Morales appears to mean it, and many Bolivians believe what he says. The money will come from the recently nationalized gas industry, supplemented by international lending and foreign investment. The plan, presented in the presidential palace in La Paz, also aims to deliver more basic public services such as school meals and better access to clean water. This from the BBC.
Chinese Prime Minister Wen Jiabao has had talks with Egypt's President Hosni Mubarak at the start of an African tour aimed at boosting economic links. They discussed bilateral relations and the latest Middle East developments. China said it was ready to increase investment in Egypt, especially in oil, natural gas, and telecommunications. The Chinese Prime Minister earlier signed a number of agreements on oil and natural gas and telecommunications after arriving in Cairo on Saturday. Wen Jiabao's visit coincided with the 50th anniversary of diplomatic relations with Egypt. Trade between the two countries exceeded $2 billion in 2005. Wen's tour of seven states takes him next to Ghana. The other stops on his itinerary are Angola, Congo-Brazzaville, South Africa, Tanzania, and Uganda. Observers say this underlines the strategic importance of Africa in Beijing's efforts to acquire energy and raw materials for its booming economy. Last year, trade between China and Africa rose to $40 billion. This from the BBC.
Reports from Nigeria say that at least 8 people have been killed in clashes in the southeastern city of Onitsha. Residents told the BBC 2 police stations were burned down and 2 armored cars were set ablaze when crowds went on the rampage last Friday. Police denied there had been any deaths, but a separatist Biafran group said 8 of its members were killed. The Masab group said on Thursday 7 of its members died in a police raid on one of its meetings outside Onitsha. Masab, the movement for the actualization of the sovereign state of Biafra, campaigns for the secession of southeastern Nigeria for the Igbo ethnic group. Masab's founder and leader, Ralph Uwazuri, and some of his followers are in jail facing treason charges. The Igbos fought to break away from the rest of Nigeria during a 3-year civil war that ended in 1970.
This has been the KBOO Morning News for Monday, June 19th, 2006. Thanks for listening. I'm Jake Wallner.
I'm Chris Andre.
Today's editor is Chris Andre. Kathleen Stevenson is the KBOO AM News and Public Affairs Director. We clear the air at 90.7 FM in Portland, 91.9 in the Columbia River Gorge on translator K246AA, and 100.7 in the Willamette Valley on translator K220HR. If you'd like to volunteer in the AM newsroom, call Kathleen Stevenson at 503-231-8032, extension 202, or email amnews@kboo.org. Portland area weather, morning clouds, partial afternoon clearing, highs in the mid-60s to mid-70s. Tonight, mostly cloudy, lows in the 50s.